Hey, what's up, everybody? Welcome to Movies Never Say Die. This is the VHS Vault, your ticket back to the video store era when the weekends meant walking the aisles for that perfect movie or movies. This series aims to dig into the rental classics that I think helped define the home video era during the 1990s, covering a wild blend of notable hits, cult classics, forgotten gems, lost movies, and unapologetic B-movie glory. In this series, we're cracking open the nostalgia cabinet to celebrate all those movies that you rented with your friends, the box art that sold you before the trailer did, and the weird, absurd, wonderful titles that only made sense at 11:15 at night when closing time was looming. So, if you love 90s movies, VHS nostalgia, and the lost art of the weekend rental, you're in the right spot. Pop in 1994's Brain Scan and watch a teen CD-ROM turn into a crime scene. Edward Furlong is the horror-obsessed kid who thinks he's playing a game. Frank Langella is the detective who knows better, and T. Ryder Smith's trickster is the leather-clad bad influence that your mom warned you about in a movie where the line between level complete and felony committed gets more than a little blurry. Now, Brain Scan is what happens when a 90s CD-ROM gets a wicked hairdo, a leather jacket, and a criminal record. Directed by John Flynn, the tough and unpretentious hand behind many films, including Stallone's Lock Up and Steven Seagal's Out for Justice, this one stars Edward Furlong as Michael, a horror-loving teen who boots up this interactive game that starts scripting real-world body counts. Frank Langella prowls as the detective who's allergic to coincidences, while T. Ryder Smith's delightfully over-the-top trickster just slithers in like a glam rock imp, being part demon and part guidance counselor from hell.
Please allow me to introduce myself. My name is Trickster.
But what holds up isn't just the VR panic premise, it's the mood overall. This movie was a complete mind trip for me as a teen. Flynn shoots suburban bedrooms like just mausoleums for forgotten mixtapes, then lets the trickster crash the party with practical makeup and sly line readings that feel ripped from a midnight cable marathon. But beneath the teen thriller shell, you can still feel the darker pulse of Andrew Kevin Walker's screenplay, which does give the kills a mean, queasy charge that certainly outlasts all the 90s tech that's on display. On the rental wall, Brain Scan was that classic clerk recommendation. It was too odd for the multiplex, but perfect for a weekend stack of VHS tapes between The Lawnmower Man and maybe Candyman. The tape's afterlife just thrived on word of mouth, and that cover art practically dared you to rent it and just rewind it again after you watch it the first time. It's really a time capsule of dial-up dread and Gen X isolation that now plays like cinematic comfort food. In Eve of Destruction from 1991, Gregory Hines chases a rogue android who looks exactly like her inventor, both played by Renee Sutendick, bringing two-for-one chaos energy here. The bots packing more than attitude, the clock is ticking, and every trip to the Versatile becomes a boss fight. You'll come for Hines's calm, cool energy, but you'll stay for the blend of late 80s, early 90s energy. Two Renees for the price of one and a city on edge. Eve of Destruction is just the kind of retro, neon, noir, techno thriller that used to pretty much whisper to you from the action wall, begging you to rent it. Directed by Duncan Gibbons, it pairs the smooth authority of Gregory Hines with the ice and embers dual turn of Renee Sutendick as both Dr. Eve Simmons and as her runaway android duplicate, Eve 8. The setup here, it's deliciously pulpy. A field test goes sideways, big shocker there, and the android then observes and absorbs the worst of human memories and turns into a pretty much a walking doomsday device, pure speed running urban anxiety where bank lobbies, diners, subway platforms, anything are all essentially levels in a very bad but still entertaining video game. What makes it fun today isn't all the cutting-edge tech on display, although it is enjoyably nostalgic. Really, it's just the early 90s vibe of this movie, with trench coats and payphones, high anxiety and ticking hearts that are literally a bomb. Hines plays it cool from start to finish, with no quips wasted, while Suit and Dick toggles between creator and creation with just a precise chill that just really gives the chase at the core of it all a real sting. I think Gibbons shoots the city like a hazard course of fluorescent reflections and plate glass dread, and really the squibby action just effectively scratches that Orion logo itch that meant weekend night thrills were incoming.
Well, this is quite some toy you have yourself, Sir General. I suppose you want me to put it back in its box.
On VHS, it was the perfect one more tape grab. The logline sold itself, the runtime didn't overstay its welcome, and you could shelve it right next to Runaway or Class of 1999 for a Robo Trouble double feature. The Super delivers Joe Pesci as the world's worst landlord, who gets forced into living in his own building until he fixes it. With Vincent Gardini as his father and Reuben Blades keeping him honest, Pesci's slumlord discovers that the tenants are people, radiators have personality, and karma has a clipboard. It's pretty much a court-ordered crash course in being human, complete with punchlines and plumbing. Court says community service, karma says pack a bag. Director Rod Daniels crafts a movie that essentially starts as cartoon punishment and then turns into a crash course in humanity, complete with broken boilers, loud arguments, and tenants who refuse to be background noise, with Vincent Gardini as the slumlord father who thinks fines are cheaper than human compassion, and an awesome Reuben Blades anchoring the tenant side with a quiet steal. This movie just effectively balances broad gags with character growth nicely for mindless fun.
You like this car, Naomi? This is my car.
I'm counsel for the housing authority.
Get off the car.
Plot-wise, it's simple and smart for effective humor. Just put the problem on the other side of the door and make the guy live with it. Literally. Daniel, the filmmaker behind Teen Wolf, keeps the pace spry, keeps the tone bouncy, so even the lectures do land with a comical rim shot. And as for Joe Pesci, who was freshly minted as Hollywood's fastest talker at this time, was able to find a different gear in this character. Still very snappy, but increasingly sheepish as the building and the people inside slowly started to matter. On VHS, The Super worked because the logline sold itself in 5 seconds at the counter, and the box art made it a no-drama family pick despite its R rating. Now, it's kind of a time capsule of early 90s issue comedies where civic headaches became life lessons and punchlines, and today I think this movie kind of plays like a warm sitcom with sharper elbows. Bob Clark's Loose Cannons from 1990 pairs Gene Hackman's gruff detective with Dan Aykroyd's brilliant but wildly eccentric partner to track down a very dangerous reel of film. The case is serious. The tone is not. Aykroyd's pop culture egos crash every stakeout. Dom DeLuise pops by and Hackman plays the straight man like he's defusing a whoopee cushion. Now, if you ever wanted Gene Hackman scowling and lumbering through a buddy cop movie while Dan Aykroyd shapeshifts into pretty much an entire video store's worth of impressions, well then Loose Cannons is your oddly specific wish granted. Directed by curveball specialist Bob Clark, known for movies like Black Christmas, A Christmas Story, and Porky's, this one throws a grizzled DC detective together with a brilliant but unstable partner, and of course, buddy comedy antics and hijinks ensue. The MacGuffin is serious, the tone, like I said, is definitely not. Expect car chases, quick quips, situational laughs, and comedic absurdity, and it's a total blast.
You having a bad day?
No, I'm having a terrible day. Say something nice to me, will you, please?
You have very strong-looking thighs for a white man.
I like that, yeah.
The plot overall is classic rental-era bait. Odd couple plus explosive secrets equals 94 minutes of pizza-friendly chaos. Hackman plays exasperation like a martial arts, while Aykroyd's alter egos crash stakeouts and interrogations with equal abandon. I've always been a huge Aykroyd fan, and I remember stumbling onto this movie on cable. My friends and I loved it. I mean, buddy comedies were a dime a dozen, but We love this dime for how wild it was. I think Clark was able to just stitch together thriller mechanics smoothly into like sketch comedy detours, making a movie that kind of felt like you were cable surfing without even touching the remote. On VHS, Loose Cannons was able to live in that sweet spot where the names on the box pretty much did the heavy lifting. Gene Hackman and Dan Aykroyd, got it, I'll give it a rental. Now, as for the mood, it also kind of told you, we're not here to harsh your weekend. And really, this movie is just a peak example of the post-Lethal Weapon boom when a buddy cop movie could mean anything from neo-noir to Looney Tunes. And today, it kind of plays like an eccentric time capsule. It's half stakeout, half sketch show, and exactly the kind of offbeat rental your clerk friend swore was much better than the reviews would tell you. In The Last of the Finest from 1990, director John McKenzie turns four blue-collar cops, Dennehy, Pantoliano, Fahey, and Paxton, into off-the-books Avengers after a busted raid smells like a cover-up. Think tailgates as war rooms, denim-level justice, and a conspiracy that goes way past the precinct water cooler. This movie is blue-collar justice with a blue flashing siren. The Last of the Finest hands four just workhorse actors, a moral crusade, and lets them go to work. Brian Dennehy, Joe Pantoliano, Jeff Fahey, and Bill Paxton. I mean, can you get a better rock-solid quartet of 90s character actors than that? I mean, they play LA narc cops, they get bounced after a raid goes sideways, and they decide to go off-book to smoke out a drug pipeline using friends in very high places. The plot is very meat and potatoes. You got tense confrontations, backyard intel, cash drops under bad lighting, but McKenzie films it all with a street grit and just a bruised conscience that makes really every busted lead feel like a dent in the American dream.
What do you think? The department is going to go after Hojo's killer?
What the hell do you think that FBI guy was doing at Frank's hearing?
We can only do this on our own.
Dennehy anchors the squad with a weary authority, Pantoliano brings live wire schemer energy, Fahey supplies the quiet burn, and Paxton adds that scrappy charisma that made him a 90s MVP. I mean, everybody gets their moment. It's the kind of ensemble that just smells like motor oil and diner coffee in all the best ways. This was a video store gem I stumbled onto when a friend's older brother rented it. The movie was released overseas as Blue Heat, which means some of us may have actually rented this movie twice under two different covers. Because on VHS, it lived in that rogue cop procedural block right between Internal Affairs and Unlawful Entry, because the logline sold itself. It's time for heroes again, good guys versus a system that forgot how to be good, and The Last of the Finest is a snapshot of just pre-digital policing where shoe leather, bar tabs, and a stubborn conscience carry the day. So if your 90s stack of tapes needs a blue-collar crusade with real bite, this one still throws plenty of elbows. Necessary Roughness from 1990 passes a busted college football program to director Stan Dragotti and says, good luck. It's misfit squad football. It's got big heart, bigger helmets, an old quarterback, a lady kicker, and enough jokes to still deliver on a Tuesday. In this one, the whistle blows and hope limps out onto the field. Necessary Roughness centers on a college football program completely nuked by sanctions, forcing them to rebuild with completely spare parts. Enter Scott Bakula as the 34-year-old quarterback dusting off his arm, Hector Elizondo as the granite-jawed coach, Robert Loggia as the skilled, steely assistant coach, Sinbad as the enforcer of comedic relief, and Kathy Ireland as the clutch place kicker who flips expectations and the scoreboard. The plot, I think, here is the good kind of predictable. You get your misfit armadillos assembling their team. They, of course, take their lumps, and they, of course, then learn to move the chains with stubborn heart and duct tape. Dragotti keeps the tone bouncy and the playbook simple. Montages that actually build character, jokes that don't undercut the huddle, and just enough gridiron thump to make you lean forward when the action kicks in. I think Bakula's worn-in charm does a bunch of the work. Hector Elizondo does a bunch of the work as well with just precision comedic timing, while Robert Loggia just kind of cements the entire cartoonish world with a little bit of grounded validity.
I hope hope he gets younger as he gets closer.
On tape, this was the safest rental in the sports aisle. Funny enough for a weekend, wholesome enough for family, and more than football enough for roommates who only wanted to rent Rudy. It would get spun up annually every fall like clockwork, right next to the program, for a perfect double feature that would turn snack tables into tailgate parties. And overall, I think this movie is the Rosetta Stone for early 90s teen comedies. You got earnest underdogs, faculty sass, and a kicker who walks so a generation of sports movie curveballs could run, and all these years later it plays like a pep rally that you actually wanted to go to. Ted Demme's Who's the Man from 1993 graduates two Harlem barbers, Ed Lover and Dr. Dre, into rookie cops who immediately trip into a real case. And between Dennis Leary's bark, Ice-T's glare, and a parade of hip-hop cameos, the duo is going to have to solve a neighborhood mystery without losing a beat or their badge numbers in a film that claimed to be a hip-hop whodunit. Badge would meet the boombox in Who's the Man. MTV's Ed Lover and Dr. Dre go from Harlem barbers to rookie cops who can barely keep a straight face, let alone a straight line. The plot here is a breezy caper, a murdered mentor, a shady redevelopment scheme, and two new officers who have to protect their neighborhood. The hook is the culture. Mid-93 hip-hop cameos just parade through like a Saturday afternoon radio show. Dennis Leary is nearly having a coronary. Ice-T is being pure Ice-T, and just a ton of other familiar faces duck in and out for punchlines and nods, making the entire thing like an amusement park ride. As a comedy, it's Hangout first, Chase second. Demme keeps the pace light, the jokes land, then the story sneaks in with, I think, just enough stakes to matter. Lover's easy charisma and Dre's deadpan make them a classic optimist and realist pair. On the rental wall, this movie just lived in that perfect weekend spot. You'd grab it for the cameos, keep it for the vibe, and end up quoting it all week.
We're here to fight the forces of evil, to make the streets safe for you people to walk on.
Look at you looking like before and after.
Now, its pop culture imprint is a bit modest, but shelved alongside CB4 and House Party, it's a solid time capsule of early 90s New York, with big jackets, bigger hair, endless 90s starter gear, and an even bigger sense of place. And today it's like a community scrapbook with a buddy cop spine, warm, funny, and proudly local, and it remains a feel-good rap era snapshot with a mystery that never harshes the mood. After watching Wishmaster from 1997, you may change your opinion on wanting three of them, as Robert Kurtzman unleashes a late 90s special effects party as Andrew Devoff plays an evil djinn granting desires with a homicidal fine print, while horror legends Robert Englund and Tony Todd and a who's who of other familiar faces pop in for nightmare savory herbs and seasonings. This is a gleeful carnival ride of terror that knows exactly how to twist the knife. Be careful what you wish for, then be careful how you phrase it. Wishmaster unleashes Robert Kurtzman on the ultimate monkey paws premise. Andrew Devoff, the bad guy from Toy Soldiers, plays an ancient djinn in this movie who grants wishes with a lawyer's love of loopholes and a carnival barker's grin, while Tammy Lauren anchors the chase as a gemologist stuck outwitting a creature that weaponizes semantics and your own greed.
I remember a certain potentate whose last party was talked about for centuries.
God, how I'd love to host a party like that.
The fun is tactile, the late 90s CGI is pure nostalgia fuel, and the swagger is complete with transformations, mutilations, and gotcha gags that are pretty much designed for pausing and rewinding. Kurtzman stages each wish like a wicked little magic trick, and the movie also doubles as a horror fan mixer, with Robert Englund, Tony Todd, and many other genre icons popping in, all like surprise guests at a convention panel. And as a rental, Clerks pitched it as if Hellraiser met Tales from the Crypt and the franchise Tale. Three direct-to-video sequels told you exactly how hard it hit on home video. Review-wise, it's a proudly pulpy movie, but Devoff's velvety menace and the time capsule special effects more than elevate the mayhem into just 90s creature feature highlights, and Wishmaster, I think, sits in that late decade pocket where throwback monster craft was able to meet meta fandom. In 1991's Pure Luck, Nadia Tass teams Martin Short's catastrophically unlucky accountant with Danny Glover's unflappable PI to track down an heiress who makes Murphy's Law look optimistic. Every clue is a comical mishap, every detour is a disaster, and somehow the worst luck keeps finding the right trail in a movie that's all Looney Tunes with passports and bee stings. The universe is a slapstick comedian in Pure Luck, where director Nadia Tass teams up Martin Short with Danny Glover to create an unlikely effective comedic duo. Their mission in this one is to find an heiress whose bad luck is practically a superpower. The setup here is really so simple it's elegant. She's unlucky, so send the most unluckiest accountant on earth to follow the breadcrumb trail of disasters to find her, because it's 90s cinema and of course only he can. Short is able to turn pratfalls into plot beats, doors, stairs, wildlife, all conspirators to his parade of laughs, while Glover's granite patience becomes the film's comedic engine. Tass keeps the tone sunny and the pace skip along brisk, peppering the Mexico road trip with just a string of absurd hijinks that somehow keep nudging the investigation forward. It's the kind of PG-friendly chaos that just made video stores hum back in the day. Parents can watch it, kids can cackle, and nobody really is arguing with the pick.
I don't believe in that shit. I believe in logic, reason, hard work. That's how we're going to find it. What are you doing now?
And Pure Luck really is comfort comedy. Low stakes warmth, clean staging, and that classic precision clown meets immovable straight man chemistry that was an essential part of the early 90s star combo wave that would pair big personalities for travel-sized adventures, and on VHS, it was a go-to palate cleanser, perfect between a thriller and a horror tape because it promised laughs without hangovers, and if your VHS stack needed a breezy reset button with genuine charm, then Pure Luck landed on its feet after, of course, tripping over 3 suitcases and a potted plant. Hudson Hawk from 1991 delivers Bruce Willis singing his way through Da Vinci-themed robberies with Danny Aiello, while Richard E. Grant and Sandra Bernhard chew scenery like it's a gourmet meal. Andy McDowell flirts in code, the CIA gets weird, and every caper is timed to a tune in a movie that you'll either love or hate, but still quote. Cappuccinos, musical cues, and smash and grabs. Hudson Hawk is director Michael Lehman's cartoon heist, where Bruce Willis and Danny Aiello time robberies to pop standards and flirt with catastrophe like it's a professional sport. My buddy and I were so into this movie as kids. The hyper-reality, the absurdity, the style, the coolness of Bruce Willis, all of it appealed to us as teens, and we still love this movie to this day. The plot is a Rube Goldberg machine, Da Vinci MacGuffins, alchemy gizmos, and CIA weirdos, while Richard E. Grant and Sandra Bernhard cackle as nouveau riche supervillains, and Andy McDowell just floats through all the chaos on a breeze of her own charisma. As a movie, it's a complete vibe check. Screwball rhythms, comic book logic, and needle drops used like lockpicks. And if you are able to tune into this movie's frequency, it will be complete bliss. If not, it's going to be pure chaos. But either way, it will be unforgettable. Layman, with writer Daniel Waters in the mix, leans really into Looney Tunes physics and deadpan patter, letting Willis play a vaudeville cat burglar who'd rather harmonize than hack a keypad.
Oh, I hate when this happens. Girls, can I ask you a question? How do I look?
Like a fraternity thing?
Now, as for Hudson Hawk's video store life, it was legendary. After a very rocky theatrical run, this tape would become a cult migration pattern. One friend would insist, you just don't get it. You don't understand. And then suddenly it was 2 a.m. and you're debating cappuccino foam. I think Hudson Hawk is the patron saint of love it or hate it 90s rentals, proof that home video could really rescue the weird and give it an audience. So if your stack of VHS tapes needs some bold flavor between a couple of straight shooters, Hudson Hawk is the cappuccino martini of capers. It's sweet, it's spiky, and likely to inspire an impulsive sing-along while the safe cracks open on the downbeat. And that's it for today, guys. That's a wrap. Rewind it, toss it back into the clamshell. This episode of the VHS Vault is officially checked in. Now, if any of tonight's rentals sparked a memory, hit like, subscribe, tap that notification bell so the neon open sign always stays lit over on your feed. Drop your own overrented 90s picks down in the comments, those tapes you wore out, the covers you couldn't resist, the oddball titles you picked because the clerk said they were better than the reviews. I'd love to hear your guys' selections. Stay tuned for next time. We're digging deeper into the back room, more cold heat, more lost labels, more movies that made every weekend feel like a holiday. So be kind, rewind. Thank you guys so much for watching. I'll see you guys in the next video. And until then, movies never say die.
Jack Burton and the Pork Chop Express, and I'm talking to whoever's listening out there.
Survive a war, you gotta become war.
I suppose we have to register you as a lethal weapon.
You trying to say Jesus Christ can't hit a curveball?
What's up out there, everybody? Welcome to Movies Never Say Die and to another episode of the VHS Vault. Tonight, we're cracking open another fresh stack of rentals, the kind that you used to put into the order of a watch list on the car ride home. I personally think this lineup is pure Friday night energy. We start by getting cozy, then we get silly. We're going to take a few glossy detours into danger and then ride out with some Western swagger. Think about the warm glow of an old tube TV, the sound of a tape winding up in the VCR, and that unwritten rule that whoever returned the tapes the next day got to pick the first movie. So secure your snacks, get comfy, and let's take a trip back to the video store. In Doc Hollywood from 1991, Michael J. Fox and Julie Warner turn a chance meeting into a small town cure for big city ambitions, where it turns out the fastest route to happiness might be a detour with decent coffee and neighbors that know your name. Now, this was a fixture on the new releases wall that somehow felt like it was a comfort pick. The pop culture imprint isn't necessarily loud as much as it is cozy, with the early 90s faith and small town atmosphere, the soft flannel vibe, and the idea that success can look like a Saturday morning pancake breakfast. On VHS, it played like background sunshine, something that you would throw on while friends debated over pizza toppings, dished on who was dating who, and argued over which tape to watch next. Now, what I love about it is how it just refuses to be slick. It lets the scenes breathe. It gives the characters room to become people that you could actually imagine bumping into at the pharmacy, and it treats little detours like little secret doors. So really, it's a movie that I think feels very lived in. It's the kind of rental that turned weekends into little resets by rewinding life a little bit, maneuvering a slower track, and remembering that ambition doesn't always have to shout at you in the face.
I'm just on my way to Beverly Hills. Plastic surgery. Not that you need any.
And this era of cinema adored these city mouse meets country mouse plot lines, and few did it with as much charm and charisma as Michael J. Fox and Julia Warner in this movie. I mean, every watch of Doc Hollywood feels like a postcard from an analog decade, and it's just a gentle rom-com with a very generous heart, the exact tape you just would keep for an extra day and hope the store clerk didn't notice, because returning it felt like you were leaving a small town. Now, from small town heartbeats, we're going to jump into big what-if swings in this next movie that aims to see if one pitch could have changed a person's life. In 1990's Mr. Destiny, Jim Belushi, Michael Caine, and Linda Hamilton attempt to write a one-swing what-if redo that rewrites a life and delivers a truly one-of-a-kind baseball movie that captures a timeless sense of wonder. Now, if you ever rented this one near opening day, you were not alone. Sports fans like myself and Belushi fans like myself practically wore this tape thin. I think it fit perfectly beside the era's wish fulfillment comedy section, but smuggled in that grown-up idea that an alternate life can come with alternate problems. On the shelf when it was released, it sat nicely between baseball fantasies and workplace fables by borrowing a little bit of magic from both, and the pop culture imprint here is pretty sly. It isn't quoting locker room posters as much as it is interrogating them, and on tape it really did become ritual cinema. Watch, dream, then go take a few swings out on the playground. That's the nostalgia charge for me, at least. A movie about tallying imaginary RBIs, all the while talking yourself into the best version of yourself that you can be.
Hitting that baseball has spun your life off in an entirely new direction.
And of course, rewatching now, the jokes feel warmer, the fine print reads much clearer, bigger doesn't always equal better, and the scoreboard isn't the only measure that matters in life. And in the rental ecology, this was that movie that would keep getting recommended by that cool clerk that you knew had some taste. It's a movie that's safe for family night, but honest enough to sting the emotions a little bit, and I think it's a durable feel-good movie that matures like a glove. It's broken in, more forgiving, and somehow more yours every time you pick it up. Now, if fate can flip your scorecard, imagine what a good disguise can do in this next movie. In Nuns on the Run from 1990, Eric Idle and Robbie Coltrane attempt to hide from their crime boss by ducking into a convent where disguises, choir practice, and comical chaos will collide. Bless me, Father, for I have giggled. This is the definition of a glorious video store accident. You go hunting for an action tape and you end up grabbing the Is This Funny cover just out of curiosity, and boom, you have an instant surprise classic in your living room on VHS. It became a word of mouth comment. Your friend's cousin swore by it, then you swore by it like you had stumbled onto it, and pretty soon it felt like a private club with a universal password. Pop culture-wise, it rode that British invasion comedy wave, clever without bragging, a farce that respected timing more than volume, and I think the nostalgia toke in this one is everywhere. The grain of the tape, the muffled hi-fi stereo, and now it's a timestamp to the glorious days of adult comedies, movies that were ridiculous without being ridiculous.
Run a teacher training college for 18 to 22-year-old girls. You have experience.
Of 18-year-old girls, yes, plenty.
And I think what keeps this one fresh is just its absence of meanness. I mean, even the crooks feel human and likable. The convent isn't a punchline so much as it is a playground, and the script trusts that you're going to catch the second layer jokes, if not on a rewatch. And in the rental era, this was prime. Second choice becomes first favorite energy, the kind of tape you would bring over to a friend's house and pretend that you discovered it on purpose. And I just think it's a lovable stealth classic whose true punchline is really how well it has aged over time. Clean, nimble, and always two jokes ahead of you. Now, let's trade the nun outfits for neon onesies as we hit the slopes in this next rental gem. On the slopes of 1990's Ski Patrol, Roger Rose and T.K. Carter prank, carve, and rally to save their mountain from a cartoonish takeover. This is a movie that's 100% powder, pratfalls, and PG-rated absurdity that'll make you want to grab your gear and hit the slopes. You can smell the artificial snow in this movie. Okay, maybe that was the rental shop's carpet cleaner, but regardless, it lived on the comedy wall all winter like a neon trail marker in the pop culture landscape. It's ski town goofball cinema at cruising speed, PG rated with prank wars, VHS era soundtrack bops, and villainy with cartoon mustaches. I've personally always been fonder of Ski School, but the nostalgia here really does hit like an avalanche. The bright jackets, the cutaway gags, the sense that half the stunts were signed off by a guy named Sully holding a hot cocoa. And as a rental, it did exactly what you wanted on a Friday. It kicked open the weekend, got everyone laughing, and made you plan for a trip to the mountains that you more than likely would never take.
How you doing, ladies?
What I appreciate about it now is its handmade charm. It's Police Academy out on the ski slopes with set pieces that actually look performed and not composited, with jokes that trust the wide shot and a breezy rhythm that never pretends to be cooler than it actually is. It's pre-irony and proudly so. It's a movie that you would pop in to let the mountain air into the living room, and while it's certainly not the apex of slopes out in the subgenre, it is a reliable chairlift to some pretty fun, good vibes. It's an annual preseason ritual watch that reminds you fun doesn't have to be always high altitude. It just has to feel elevated. Now, from snowy mountains and fun-loving rejects, we're moving to neighborhood superheroes in this next movie. In The Meteor Man from 1993, Robert Townsend, backed by Marla Gibbs and Eddie Griffin, uses his freshly zapped superpowers to protect the block, one act of kindness at a time, in a superhero comedy about a neighborhood watch that just got a big upgrade from space. Back in the day, if you were scanning the new releases wall and you wanted some superhero vibes without all the grim dark, this box art would call to you like a porch light, and on the couch with friends, it would become participation cinema. You would cheer the tiny wins, roast the clunky bits, and pass the chips, and then repeat it all over again. Its pop culture imprint is bigger than most people remember. It was an early, earnest black superhero on a mainstream shelf, preaching community care years before it would become a marketing buzzword, and the nostalgia here is pretty much all tactile. It's late night channel surfing that accidentally turns into a full watch. It's sitting with that one friend who quotes the same line every time you guys watch it. It's the sound of the VCR rewinding before another sit down. It's that movie's secret weapon. It's really the sincerity and the humor of everything, and it's all led by the comically charming performance from Robert Townsend in the lead.
Meteor Man's in town.
It imagines superpowers as neighborhood tools, cleaning up the streets, protecting kids, rebuilding dignity. That sweetness isn't naive, it's intentional, and sure, not every gag here is a swish, but the team chemistry here keeps the score close, and even in the rental era, it would thrive as a hangout pick, and I still think it's an unsung cape flick whose heart aged better than most of the VX-filled reels that we see. Proof that sometimes the smallest heroics can leave the longest afterglow. Now, from the neighborhood and heroics, we're going to step into global basketball in this next rental gem. In The Air Up There from 1994, Kevin Bacon chases a generational basketball recruit out into rural Africa, and because this was 90s cinema, he learns that teamwork is the real winning play. You're going to come for the scouting trip, and you're going to stay for the heartwarming assists. Now, this one was one of those cable to VHS staples growing up, the kind that you'd tape off of TV with the commercials and all, and pretty much treat it like a basketball training montage next to movies like Hoop Dreams and Blue Chips and Above the Rim. Or maybe that was just teenage me who had dreams of being a point guard in the NBA. Regardless, as for this movie's pop culture footprint, I think it sits comfortably in the 90s sports journey lane, road miles, cultural bridges, and team first lessons. To me, the nostalgia here is half movie, half ritual. You watch it, then you go outside and shoot hoops until the streetlights said it was time to quit. And what keeps it charming now really is the collaborative spirit. It isn't here to crown a savior, it's here to show the give and take of a game that really does belong to everyone on the court. And on the rental wall, it was the trust me, you'll like it pick, a movie that would pacify the whole room, sports kids satisfied, comedy fans appeased, and most importantly, parents unbothered.
Winabi.
Winabi, yeah.
Hey. Talangundo alibomazao ken na winabi.
The laughs are easy, the setbacks here are human-sized, and the payoff feels like a clean swish that you can hear more than see, and today it's still a very replayable booster shot for hoop dreams and humility, served best with a scuffed ball, a squeaky rim, and of course, a side of bacon. Now, this next rental movie, we're heading into corporate America, where in the office, the real danger often wears a name badge. Time to clock in with The Temp from 1993, starring Laura Flynn Boyle, Timothy Hutton, and Faye Dunaway in a glossy office thriller where brewing ambition sharpens like a letter opener, so sharp that even HR can't figure out what to do with it. Now, second-run theaters and video store shelves were essentially made for this exact flavor of thriller, glossy, delightfully petty, and dangerously close to your real life.
I'm not selling secrets, Charlotte.
Well, what are you doing, Peter? What's going on? You have been acting like an insane...
Well, someone in this company is trying to destroy me!
The pop culture context of this movie puts it in that 90s corporate menace mini-boom, using ambition as a horror trope, espressos as prop weapons, and using glass offices as fish bowls for bad behavior. And on VHS, it was a perfect let's do one more pick, a tight runtime, a steady ratchet of the tension with a finale that lands before the snacks run out. The nostalgia of The Temp lives in the atmosphere to the era when copiers would jam, when 90s corporate ambition could get you killed, with the Hush soundtrack insisting that nothing is wrong, and box art promising you'll never trust a new intern again. The restraint is what sells it. The stakes are small enough to feel real. Promotions become MacGuffins. Smiles turn into alibis, and it's a satisfyingly just tidy paranoia snacks that I think's aged into retro comfort. Now, from corporate mind games, we're turning into the mind itself and exploring how twisted of a maze one can be. The twisty Raising Cain from 1992, John Lithgow and Lolita Davidovich navigate a De Palma funhouse of jealousy, murder, and fractured identity, with both learning that when the mirror starts talking back to you, it's already a wrap on your sanity. This was one of those Discovery Night classics. You'd grab it for the director's name or the ominous box art and end up staying to see Lithgow detonate every 5 minutes, only to end up discussing split screens like you were in film school. Now, as for its pop culture imprint, I think it's De Palma's maximalist stamp, operatic camera work, ornate suspense, and just unhinged performances, all filtered through early 90s thriller mania.
This thing you're doing means everything to the old man.
I won't hurt her.
She'll hurt you.
On tape, it played like an amusement park ride that you immediately wanted to queue up again, partly to understand what you'd just seen and partly to witness the audacity of it all once again. The nostalgia here, like many of these movies, does come with the rituals, pausing to argue theories, rewinding to catch a reveal, and what I admire now really is the craftsmanship underneath all the chaos, the way seemingly stray threads click together in a final act that is both pulpy and puzzling. All of which I think makes Raising Cain just deliciously artificial in the best ways, performance as design, style as narrative, and suspense as choreography, and to this day it's a fireworks show for thriller devotees, a reminder that too much can sometimes be exactly enough. Now, after all the identity fireworks, we're going to lighten the mood with this next movie about a guy who forgets his identity every time he wakes up in the morning. In 1994's Clean Slate, Dana Carvey and Valeria Golino tackle a murder case that the lead detective seems to forget every morning, along with everything else. Every day is a new mystery in a textbook Groundhog Day premise meets SNL skit comedy sketch that was a token of 90s cinema. Clean Slate was the rental favorite turned cable TV comfort. It's the rare mystery that kind of watches like a sitcom that you never wanted to see get canceled. The pop culture placement of this little comedy sits between noir parody and post-SNL star vehicle, but the Rewatch value is its real legacy. The amnesia gag resets the clock each morning, turning every clue into a scavenger hunt prize, every side character into a potential tour guide, and that simplicity is why this silly comedy gels. The nostalgia in this movie, I think, is just baked into the cadence, the light scoring that emphasizes the levity, the dog getting a bigger laugh than some humans, that late night decision to just finish it even though you had to be at work or school in like 5 hours. There will always be a place for feel good comedies, and with Dana Carvey behind the wheels, Clean Slate certainly defines itself as one.
Don't move.
All right, zip up.
On the video rental shelf, it was a peace treaty, light enough for the comedy crowd, plotty enough for the mystery hounds, and today the analog charm glows. It has plenty of practical bits, endless amusing props, and jokes that snap effectively without elbowing your ribs, and even all these years later, it's a casual good time. It's the cinematic equivalent of finding a $5 bill in that old jacket. Now, to close out this episode, let's hit the old west for this next rental gym, and let's saddle up with a posse that writes their own rules. In the 1994 Western Bad Girls, Madeline Stowe, Mary Stuart Masterson, Andy McDowell, and Drew Barrymore play prostitutes who saddle up to rewrite the frontier on their own terms. The posse has arrived, they're armed, and they will have the last word. On the rental wall, this was the poster that you noticed, even if you pretended that you didn't. Dust, dynamite, and a posse that meant business, its pop culture imprint. I'd call it the 90s push to remix classic genres with new leads, female counter-programming to the boys-only bunkhouse that many of the guys still enjoyed as well.
You touch her again, you're a dead man.
On VHS, it became sleepover currency, rewatchable showdowns, costume party inspirations, peak sexual charge, and just enough swagger to make you practice that over-the-shoulder glare in the mirror when no one was around. The nostalgia here really lies in its atmosphere again, taped grain over sunset skies, the click of the VCR as the score swells, and the slow-motion shots of peak 90s melodrama. Rewatching it now, I love how straight it plays the myth. There's no footnotes, no apologies, just all velocity and attitude. And does every beat kill? Not at all, but the moxie is the point, and I think the moxie lands. I think in the ecosystem of weekend rentals, this was certainly a strong closer, a go big or go home final pick that often sent everyone out the door with a smile on their face, talking about what they just watched. Today, I still think it's a stylish, hard-hitting ride. It keeps the hats on the heroes' heads. It keeps the horizon open. It's the exact kind of outlaw energy that we rented movies to engage with in the first place. And that's the stack for today, guys. All rewound and ready to drop in the return slot, or maybe keep one an extra day and risk the late fee. We went from pancake breakfast heartwarmers to wild card capers, from powder day pranks to neighborhood heroics, from second run office paranoia to Full Tilt De Palma. Then we coasted through a comfort noir and closed it out with Boots, Dust, and Attitude. If that didn't feel like a perfect Friday night shelf, I don't know what does. Now it's your guys' turn. Tell me your pick of the night in the comments. Share your favorite rental store memories, your favorite clerk recommendations, cover art that tricked you into renting the movie, the tapes that you guys rented routinely and wore thin, and of course, if you had fun, hit the like button, subscribe, ring the notification bell so episode 3 pops up right when you're hunting for your next weekend watch. Because we've got plenty more cozy detours, cult corner surprises, and a few gloriously questionable choices on deck, because that's what made the video store ritual so legendary. Thanks for hanging out, guys. I hope you have enjoyed this video. I hope you guys have been enjoying all these series based on the rental store eras from the 80s and 90s. I appreciate all of you guys watching. I'll see you guys all in the next video coming real soon. And until then, movies never say die.
Jack Burton and the Pork Chop Express, and I'm talking to whoever's listening out there.
Flag of war. You gotta become one.
I suppose we have to register you as a lethal weapon.
You trying to say Jesus Christ can't hit a curveball?